Christian, greetings to everyone this morning. It's been a blessing to be here. I find the subject that Brother Matthew was teaching very like this one, very foundational. You might say visceral, inside. The question of why we teach history is different than how to teach history. Why we teach history is very basic. Psalm 78. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. He goes on saying that we have heard and known these things. Our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. Not our children. Isn't that interesting? That we don't have the right to hide history from our father's children. We don't have the right to be the break in the link, the break in the chain. There is a reason we need to study history. There are a number of reasons I want to give you to think about this morning. Mr. Martin, the sixth grade girl said, I don't like history. We were just beginning sixth grade history class that year, Latin American history. Maria, I said, how can you say that? You don't like history. History made you what you are. You're rooted in history. You poured out of the pipeline of history. How can you say that? That's probably too much for a sixth grader. I'll tell you later what she said. But the reasons we study history are that we do not know who we are. And we do not know where we are, and we do not know where we are going or what we are doing unless we are told. Without history, we do not know who we are. I don't mean as a cultural group that we are born into, but who we are as humans. Isaiah 66:3. Says, he that killeth an ox is as if he slew a man. He that sacrificeth a lamb as if he cut off a dog's neck. He that offereth an oblation as if he offered swine's blood. He that burneth incense as if he blessed an idol. Yea, they have chosen their own ways, and their soul delighteth in their abominations. It's a description of our culture. For years, I enjoyed trapping fur bears when I was a boy. And if you did any of that, then you know that groups like People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, we call it PETA, or humane societies, they tried to pass laws to stop hunting and trapping. I think it was about 1984 or 5, they succeeded in New Jersey. And in 1992, they succeeded in Colorado. And they talked. Also, they also fought farming. For years, they talked about animal husbandry. But all farmers knew that their real goal was not how to take care of animals, but to put meat out of the North American diet, to take it out. That was their real goal. Now, just lately, it's been years since I noticed anything that they did, but I saw in a news magazine some recommendations of statements that they would like to change some of our common statements. Instead of saying, don't be a dead horse, we ought to say, don't feed a fed horse. Instead of saying, take the bull by the horns, we ought to say, take the flower by the thorns. And instead of bringing home the bacon, we ought to bring home the bagels. Well, you know that won't replace the bacon. But when people say that kind of thing, you know they have bigger fish to fry. And Isaiah 66:3 here, he killeth an ox as if he slew a man. That is, PETA is consistent with their doctrine. And this is a description of their doctrine. Without revelation, you and I do not know the difference between going without clothing or killing an animal to get clothing. We don't know the difference. That is why Peter does not know that, because they do not believe history. They do not believe revelation. Without revelation, without being told, you and I do not know the difference between us eating a wolf or a wolf eating us. All we know is that we communicate more precisely, or we think we do, because we don't know wolf language. We use tools, and we don't think they do, at least not very precisely. And that's the only difference. Without history, without revelation, you and I do not know the difference between us wearing a cow skin or her wearing our skin. That's how important history is. So really, without history, all that matters slips from our grasp. All that we love will die. And without revelation, we are animals, growling for the next meal, searching for the next high, fighting for domination in the chain of predation. And you can see that kind of, can't you, in culture, in society. When history is rejected, this is the kind of behavior. So you and I, who are we? We're made in the image of God. We are to have dominion over the animals. We're to eat them. We're to clothe ourselves with them if we wish. We know it because of revelation. We know it because of history. Genesis, we read those verses already. All right, without revelation, we do not know why we are here. You know, John 1:9 tells us that the true light came into the world and it lighted every man. In the beginning, God made the heaven and the earth. The invisible things of the creation are from the creation clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. The heavens declare the glory of God, and in them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, and it gets up every morning, rejoices as a strong man to run a race. How do we know that any of this is true? How do you know? We couldn't prove those verses in the scientific sense, even if we lived to be 500 years old. We couldn't prove that. The same is true for the evolutionary scientist. He was not there either. All of the beliefs about history, about how things came to be, all those are beliefs. They are all faiths. For example, in a debate between a creation scientist and a Christian, the creation scientist said that modern science has failed to prove that evolution can be the model by which things came to be. For example, you find in layers of rocks, you find these very old, they say, forms, undeveloped, they say, mixed with present-day life forms. And the evolutionist, he said, I know all that. But he said, if the alternative is creation, that is unthinkable. Why is it unthinkable? Because if it is true that I am created in the image of God, and if it is true that I rebelled against that image, and that he provided a redeemer for me, then it is true that he is my judge. And that is what is unthinkable. History tells us why we are here. We are here to serve God. History tells us what we're doing here. I can't tell you in a short time nearly all why we study history, but I'm going to tell you some stories, and you'll get the idea, I think, from that. Our culture, our makeup, why we face certain things we do economically, even physically. You know, we live in North America. Did anybody here grow up in Latin America? A couple of you. You grew up in Latin America. And so you know that there are differences in the culture. We lived in the Philippines for many years, which was also a Spanish-dominated nation for 400 years. And so the culture is different than North American culture, which was dominated by Northern European culture. But mostly because in North America here, there was little mineral wealth, or at least not very easily noticed and extracted mineral wealth, families came here. And they came here to work. They came here to find a place to live where they could get their food. And they came together with their families. And they cared about religious oppression. And they cared about heavy taxes that they could hardly pay. And they cared about peace, about having something where they could make a life for themselves as families. In Latin America, in the places where the Spaniards dominated, it was not that way. All the first waves of Spanish explorers that came away from Spain and Portugal were soldiers of fortune. They were looking for gold. They were looking for wealth, which in South America, in Central America, was already gathered by a lot of the Aztecs and the Incas and the indigenous tribes there. And so they went there to get that, and they hauled it back, shiploads of it. And many of those shiploads are still in the bottom of the ocean. But there's a story there. That's why piracy is a story of the Caribbean. It's not, the pirates didn't catch the Mayflower. There wasn't anything on the Mayflower except poor people. They caught the ships of gold. That's what they want, the silver, all the coinage, all the things they were looting and taking back to Spain. So all they ever came for was to stay there long enough to get rich and to go back home and be rich and sit there. Or some of them that stayed to control riches, became slaveholders, became nobility, married often Indian women there. In the Philippines, a man came to our church for several weeks, and just picking one story among many here. He didn't have a job just then. He was out of money. He had worked for a wealthy lady in Manila, and he was her driver. We call him a chauffeur. But he sat around in between drives, which is most of the time, and she said, "You're sitting around too much. Cut my grass." And there we'd cut a grass with a weed eater or maybe even with a little shears by hand. And he said, "No, I will not cut your grass." And she said, "If you don't, you're going to lose your job." And he lost his job. But he would not cut that grass. And I said, "But you needed a job. I mean, you're here asking for money." And that was an easy one. Drive the car, cut the grass. "Why wouldn't you cut her grass?" "Driver lang ako," he said. "Driver lang ako. I am only a driver, and that's all I am. It's my honor. This is my profession." She broke the agreement by asking me to cut grass. You see, it was her fault. Why didn't asking for money damage his sense of honor? There's a big difference in those Northern European, that Southern European culture, that among the unsaved, what the Latin influence did was it made it ignoble to work. See, we don't deal with workaholics in places like that. We deal with workaholics in North America. It's a North American problem. It's a Japanese problem. Workaholics, they're not in that. That's history. History teaches you about that. And this even comes right into the Mennonites. I found some very interesting quotes 100 years ago. Here's this Swiss man in Ohio writing back to Switzerland. "Anyone who wishes to make this journey should think twice. The trip is difficult, more difficult than dangerous. I again say that I advise no one to come who does not find pleasure in work. The sleepy and lazy, might as well stay at home. It was never ignoble to work in North America. You know what was ignoble? To be on the dole. There's a reason for that culturally in history. Delbert Graps and Bernese Anabaptists wrote that the bounty of food, and here you'll notice where this tendency, it's historical, but it can also turn into a wrong thing among us. The bounty of food overwhelmed the first settlers. It was no exaggeration when they wrote that the poorest farmers in America eat better than the most wealthy in Switzerland. The expanse and fertility of the land impressed them greatly. And even more, they could own the land they farmed by paying a rather small sum of money. It took them some time to adjust to these conditions. They were used to great thrift. Here, thrift was of secondary importance. They were used to long, hard, steady toil ending in a completed task on their little plateau farms. But here there was no end to the work. If there was not planting and cultivating to be done, then one had to build buildings or clear more woodland or drain swampland. They seldom knew when to stop, especially when opportunity for wealth lay before them for more and more labor. I never knew this before. As a result, few lived to old age, most age rapidly. That was our people in Ohio in the early 1800s. History tells us why our culture is the way it is. We're North Americans and we struggle with this thing. Thrift is now of secondary importance, but the opportunity for more and more wealth lies before the industrious. And industriousness is good. We're going to stop there. There's many other things like that. In Tasmania, one of our first trips over there from Nationwide Churches, we met a couple, Willie and Erna Martins. Erna was the Martins. She was from German descent by way of Russia, and Willie was a Russian or Ukrainian. But they had taken her last name because when they got married, if they took her name, they could immigrate into Germany, and from there they could get to Australia. And they had her father, Johann, lived with them, very fine old couple, Christian man. He told us his story about being in the Malachna colony and being deported to coal mines in Siberia. As a boy, he worked in a state farm feeding the animals. Finally, they were determined to be enemies of the Russian Revolution, and for many years they were held in Siberia, but finally they were able to leave and fled into the Ukraine, where their daughter met her husband. But he told us this, that there was a difference between Christians and Russia. He said, when I was a boy on the state farm feeding potatoes to the cows and to the pigs, we were almost starving. And other young people, other children there from other backgrounds said, you've got to eat some of the animal food to live. But every day the overseer asked them, did you eat some potatoes? And Willie could not eat potatoes because he did not want to be beaten. He said, my father and mother taught me, their Mennonite parents, you cannot tell a lie. But the other Christian quotes, and I think probably were quite sincere people, but from a background that was a little different, they said, you have to lie to survive. And I'll just never forget how Willie looked at us and he said, I am living proof that you did not have to lie to live. But he would have told the truth and died. And we knew exactly what he meant. Why did we know that? Because our parents taught us the same thing. And it will be the same way when you deal with like politics in Russia, where there's and many of these people we appreciate, Russian Baptists, but they're quite active in the political sense, putting pressure on senators, having marches and gatherings where the Mennonite people will do nothing but pray or have some quiet meetings with leaders We understand that. Why do we understand that? It's because of history. It teaches us that. So we think the same about the situation. Now, anyone can come to this from the Word of God. But there is a history that we should be very thankful for that has to do with what we believe. Concrete convictions that come to us through history, through our heritages, understanding of the Word of God that we need to grasp for ourselves. All right, history tells us where we are. Excuse me. We are in the world, of course. We believe that because of revelation. We only know it because of revelation. Physically and spiritually, we're in the world that God made and the devil wrecked. All the wreckage is from the devil. All the sin and all the suffering. Don't forget that. It tells us where we are culturally as Mennonites and North Americans. Tells us that we're in peaceful, prosperous times that could make us lose our faith in God. How do we know that? Only because of history. You know, a few days or weeks ago, a brother and I were discussing some business decisions, and I said how that the Russian Mennonites in 2 years' time went from basically where we are to running with the clothes on their backs for their life. That was all that mattered. And I said, I think that somehow that should affect what we decide about this, how we make this decision. And he said to me, you're wrong. I guarantee you that there is not a Mennonite that ever thinks about that. You're wrong. Well, I know he was wrong because there was at least one. But history tells us we live in luxury. I'm going to quote from Delbert Gratz again. The Anabaptists in Switzerland raised oats, barley, and peas. These three, mixed, ground, and baked, composed the bread that the mountaineers ate. It was black and heavy. Yet it contained more food value than bread from the finest white flour. Their principal product was the potato, which had found its way from America to the remotest mountain districts of Europe. All the work of the field, like haying and harvesting, was done with simple tools, such as the scythe, the hand rake, and sickle. Both men and women worked during the busy season from 4 in the morning until 10 at night. Their food was simple and had little variety. Black bread, potatoes, milk, vegetables, and some meat. The latter was seldom served, perhaps on Sunday or holidays, for there was only one or two hogs generally killed for a family, probably means per year. Meat was therefore considered a rare dainty by many. There was little luxury in setting the table. The potatoes boiled with the jackets were poured out onto the table. A bowl of milk or soup was given to each. Butter and molasses did not burden the table of our parents. The good things like butter had to be taken into the village in order to purchase necessary articles from the proceeds and also to pay the annual tax. Generally, a man was considered fortunate who could support his family in an ordinary manner and pay his rent. Now, you compare this to the answers in a Bible school class that my children were at, several of my daughters were at recently. The class was challenges everyone must face. And the question was, what are some luxuries that this group ought to avoid? Here are some answers. Smartwatches. Luxury cruises. Getting a pilot's license if you don't need it. Heated steering wheels. Remote control toys. Lots of eating out. Drones. Thinking I have to have Saturdays off every week. We are in danger of having our definition of luxury totally obliterated. How do we know that? Because of history. That's the only way that we will know that. Now, history also teaches us what we can become. And I think this is so important to have this coming through your teaching in the school. Hebrews 11. Let's turn to a few verses there. You know these stories. You love this chapter. Verse 4, by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. By faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death. Verse 7, by faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet. And then we have Abraham, and we have Sarah. And finally, it seems like he just runs out of time to tell the stories. And he starts saying over in verse 32, what more shall I say? Time would fail. He says, who through faith subdued kingdoms, in verse 33, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight. And he just goes on and on with all the things that were accomplished, suffered bonds and imprisonment. There's one spot in this chapter, just in case we thought that stopping the mouths of lions and quenching fire and escape the edge of the sword, that it was all those kinds of miracles. In verse 36, there's two words, and others. And others. And then he goes on to talk about the ones that were stoned and were scourged, and they died. And they died like flies in those kind of quantities. And they wandered in deserts and in mountains. And they all obtained a good report through faith. How do you know that you can obtain a good report through faith? Because of history. That's how God tells us that we can do it, through him. Because the story is there. The account, our brother told us, is there. But we also know what else we can become through history. You know, I have this little boy, and he's 3 years old. And his brown eyes are innocent, and they're wondering, and they're curious, and they're beautiful to look at. And I suppose that none of us should, maybe like my friend said, think about things like this. But I have to, because I study history. And I look at that little boy, and I say to myself, Adolf Hitler looked like that too. How do we know that? History, that's how we know it. But is he capable of what Hitler did? Maybe he is, if his father does what Hitler's father did, which was leave his mother and leave his family. And the boy grew up in disillusionment and despair and discouragement. And he turned to something that seemed like it would be hope. I need to tell you a story about one of the trials at Nuremberg, Germany. After World War II, you know how they brought the German leaders and they tried them. The Nazi leaders, not the German, the Nazi leaders, one after all the ones that were still living. Many of them were sentenced to death. But there's a story associated with one of those trials. I think it was Hermann Göring that was being tried. And he had been responsible for the annihilation of many families, of course. But there was a case where there was still a witness. And he knew that he was responsible for destroying his family. And he was called as a witness to this trial. He had never seen Hermann. And so he came into the courtroom, and there was Hermann Göring, and he saw him, and he fell on the floor in a dead faint. And after a while, they were able to revive him. And he said, when I saw him, I could not believe that he was a normal man. All I've ever thought about him was that he must be a monster. But he said, when I saw him, he looked exactly like me. He said, and why I fainted was because I thought, I am capable of what he did. I don't know if we're all capable of that or not. But we have to believe. History teaches us what is so serious about it is because we are capable of doing all this stuff that's all around us. We're absolutely capable of it. And we are also capable of Hebrews 11. And that's where the beauty for our children comes in. It drives us into the arms of a loving God who can make us into His image. You know, I told you about Maria, and she didn't like history and what I said to her. And she said, I actually kind of like history. And it probably just to impress me. But she said, I just don't like if it's lists of names and places and things. And we all understand that, don't we? We want to read the account. We want to read the story, not just lists and names and places of things. Now, Hebrews 11 has names and lists, but why do you love that chapter? It's not because it's a list, but it's because their story is your story. You're becoming. You are one of them. We have substance of things that isn't seen by those around us. We too diligently seek Him. We too sojourn in a strange country. History tells us that. We desire a better country. Revelation tells us that. And all we really want in life is that one sentence in Hebrews 11. God is not ashamed to be called our God. That's all we want, really, when it comes down to it, isn't it? How do we know that? Because of history. And because we know that all those people that had that kind of relationship with God went where we want to go. It's all that matters. You know, if the church or school or historians or writers or museums see themselves as the curators of history, the caretaker of a museum. When you're teaching history in school, you're not the caretaker of a museum. It is a living story. If you know, I think our society treats history that way, and that is why they are dying. It's not their story. They're living for me now. And all that I think and feel is what matters. How do we know that isn't true? Because of history. Because everybody who thinks that disappears into a great void. You know, a friend of mine challenged me. He's from Milwaukee. But he attends a Mennonite church. And he said, and he watched several of the sons of in several of our families leave the church, and after a bit they were attending a Lutheran church. He said, you know what's wrong with that? He said, you aren't teaching enough Anabaptist history in your school. If they knew what the Lutherans did to them back in 15, 20, 30, 40, they'd never set foot inside a Lutheran church. It took me a while to think through that. Well, yeah, maybe we should. Maybe we should. We teach some Anabaptist history. But why aren't we just ignoring our country's history, world history, and just pounding it into these children's heads that they are Anabaptists? Why aren't we doing that? Because they aren't. Now, they are culturally Mennonites. But they are not by nature. They are not martyrs by nature. They cannot be that kind of Christian by nature, and we must not teach them that. That you are this. They have to take it by choice. They have to choose it. And you can't teach the innocent that you are that. But instead, we teach the story of the world and the story of our country with the story of God's people woven through it, and with the permanence of the one kingdom and the temporary nature of the other kingdom, so that when they come to understand their decision, they understand the consequences. And they understand, this is what I'm choosing. There's God's or there's the world's. And the world is real and it affects what is happening, but this is where I want to be. We can't write their names in Hebrews 11 until they choose it. God does it. They must choose it. God takes them there. So we teach who we are, where we are, where we are going, all because we want, when they get to that point of decision, we want it to be clear that they know what they are choosing. They have the same power of choice and the same privilege of choice that everyone else has. How do we know our history teaching is working? When our children choose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, then our history teaching is working. Then we know that we haven't glorified the world in our history teaching. When our children see history as a living cloud of witnesses, and I want, if you teach history, I want you to understand that it is alive. The ground that our feet tread on, their souls tread on. The very air in our lungs they breathed, and the water we drank, they drank. You know, people have this modern phrase nowadays for why people act the same in these different kinds of sins and cultural expressions. They say, I don't know if it's up here in Canada, it's in the U.S., it doesn't make a lot of sense. It says they're all drinking the same Kool-Aid. That's the phrase they use. They're all drinking the same Kool-Aid. Well, we're walking on the same ground that the Hebrews 11 people did. And we're breathing the same air and we're drinking the same water. And God saved or judged them according to their choice. When our children see Christ as the center of history, that is the last thing I'm going to point out, because it is the most important. We are successful in our teaching when they understand that Christ is the center of history. Divine revelation is the pith of history. And the story account of Jesus Christ is the pith of the pith. It's the middle of the middle. The center of the center. Now rest my long divided heart. Fix on this blissful center, rest. Nor ever from my Lord depart, with him of every good possessed. So we teach history because without it we do not know who we are. We do not know where we are going. We do not know what we are doing. Worst of all, we do not know what we can become. For God or against God. And we teach history because we want our people and our children to know that when you choose Christ, you have to be willing to live the truth. But in this time, we might call it a returning to some dark ages. The church is also charged with being a bank, a repository where precious things will live that are dead everywhere else. History is alive, and in your hand you hold the privilege of keeping things alive. We teach history because it teaches us the truth of John 14, 3 and 4. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. And whither I go, ye know, and the way you know. How do you know it? Because of history, because of revelation, because we've been told.